All right. This is Shar Tortorisi interviewing Steve Safian on the history of academic staff governance on April 27th, 2010. Steve, to get started, can you tell us a little bit about your education before coming to the university? Where you went to school, your degrees attained?
Sure. I have a undergraduate degree in history and political science from Brooklyn College, the City University of New York.
Okay.
And a master's degree in counseling and student personnel administration from Columbia Teachers College in New York. Can we give room for anecdotes?
Absolutely. I take it you're a New York boy.
Yeah, I am from New York. And my undergraduate advisor in history was John Hope Franklin, who was the first black department chair in the City University of New York, and later became one of the most prominent American historians, and just died about a year ago. But
wow. Did you stay in touch with him?
No. I wish I had. The other part of the story that I like to tell is when we were doing the renovation of the Red Gym, one of the programs that was going to be in the gym was the Multicultural Center. And like everybody else, they had a lot of questions about the space they were going to have and so on and so forth. And so I was invited to a meeting of the Multicultural Center, specifically I can't remember the exact name, it was the Black Students Association, and it was their custom that, as an introduction to the meeting, they'd go around the room and ask people, you know, what their relationship was to black history. And of course, they had all these African-American kids would stand up and say, you know, they grew up in a ghetto or whatever. And they just passed by me because, you know, well, I said, excuse me, you know, and I said, you know, this, I said, John Hope Franklin, and of course they had all knew who he was, because he's really quite famous, you know, many books, and if you're a historian, you know him, Rich, you know, some, a lot of people. So they all looked at me like, and then I got a round of applause, and
all right.
We got cooperation from that group, so that was kind of fun. Okay, so.
Did you go right to graduate school from undergrad?
I did. I did. I got a master's degree full-time. And then my first job was at the Brooklyn campus of Long Island University. And I was like the student activities coordinator, and they had a high-rise residence hall, and I was the assistant director of that. So I had that. And I stayed there for several years, and then I became the director of residence halls at Pratt Institute, which is a school of art and architecture in New York. And I was there for 5 years. And I came to Wisconsin when I was 30. There's another interesting story. How did I come to the University of Wisconsin?
Go West, young man.
Well, believe it or not, there was an ACPA meeting in Detroit. And it started the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated, okay? So one of my functions at the meeting was to recruit what we would call hall directors now. You know, in those days they were house mothers or whatever. But hall directors for our program was small, but we had like, I think, 1,500 kids in residence. But we did have several hall directors, and that was my mission, okay? So we got there, this event happened, and Detroit was in a lockdown. You know, the meeting was in Detroit, and they were sort of locked down. And so we weren't allowed to go out on the streets. We could stay in the hotel. We ended up sleeping, changing our rooms from downtown Detroit to Windsor, Ontario, to get out of everything that was going on. But so I can't go anywhere. I'm stuck in this sort of basement ballroom, interviewing people, and at the table next to me was Eli Meyerson and Bill, I can't remember his last name, from the University of Wisconsin.
Okay.
And so we would interview and they would interview, and then in between we'd chat, and this went on for hours because we couldn't go. Well, by the end of the interview session, Eli and Bill said to me, would you be interested in interviewing at the University of Wisconsin? And I, you know, I was anxious to leave New York. I'd been there all my life. I wanted to see what else was out there. And I said, sure. And so this was April. In June, they invited me out for an interview, and I interviewed both in residence halls with Newell Smith and Larry Halley, and in the Dean of Students' office. God, I can't even remember the names anymore. People were long since gone. And residence halls was looking for more of a business person, and the dean's office was looking for more of a student affairs type, which fit me. And they offered me a job, and I took it.
So you came in as an assistant director? Or?
No, I came in as assistant to the dean of students.
Oh, okay.
Later became, they changed it to vice chancellor, and I was assistant. When Chan Young became vice chancellor, I became assistant to the vice chancellor. And then when Paul became the dean, I became an assistant dean of students, and that's pretty much where it stayed.
When you came, was there a dean of men and a dean of women, or had it already been combined?
I think they were just sort of phasing out the dean of women's office, because I remember there was an office in Lathrop, and it was, might have been Martha Peterson.
I think it was.
Yeah. But that was, this was 1968. And I think they were just sort of phasing.
Oh, 68, I think it was gone by then.
Was it gone by then?
Yeah, that was the year I would have been a freshman. And I think there was just a dean of students office then.
I'm not sure about that. Because I remember meeting Ann Topham, who I thought was part of the dean of women's staff, who left the university and now sells goat cheese at the farmer's market. She's been doing it for the last 35 years or so.
All right, have you stayed in touch?
Well, every Saturday morning we go by and wave at Ann. You know.
How fun.
She's, okay, so, and then I came to the university and I...
Were you married?
I was married. Oh, yeah. I was
okay.
Married. We were married sort of young, you know. I don't think we were quite 22 yet when we were married, and we had children pretty quick. So by the time I got here, I had 3 kids.
Were they excited about moving?
They were still pretty young. They didn't make a fuss about moving. The grandparents were sort of mixed emotions about that.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was, the move to Wisconsin, we never second-guessed that, because living where we did in downtown Brooklyn was not really a good, at that time, was not a good place to bring up kids. And so, you know, I probably could have stayed. I was actually offered the job of dean of students 2 weeks after, at Pratt, 2 weeks after I took the job at Wisconsin. So I would have been the dean of students at Pratt, but it was a small school, and I knew I wanted to go on and get a doctor's degree if I could, and being at the University of Wisconsin would have made it easier. At Columbia, I was working in Brooklyn. You know, it was like an hour and 15 minutes on the subway to go to graduate school and go back and work. So, plus the University of Wisconsin was a very prestigious, still is. I mean, it had a tremendous reputation, and it was the kind of thing that was, when you were getting started in higher education, you get an opportunity like that, you better have a really good reason not to take it.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have a good reason not to, and so I did.
So you came on board with the position that you stayed with many years. I mean, as the job changed, you didn't have to re-interview. You just kept getting promoted and promoted as the job got bigger and bigger.
Right. But, you know, and the job evolved. Remember, in part because of the times, I actually took Sipperly's place, and the dean, Jack Sipperly, moved over to LNS, and it was his position that was vacant. And the position, as it was defined then, was to provide some sort of counseling ombudsman service for walk-ins, of which the dean of students' office was getting a lot in those days.
Oh,
well,
sure.
When I got there, it was a year after the Dow Chemical riots, and all of a sudden that kind of traffic stopped. I mean, students weren't interacting with people that had titles like deans and stuff.
And they were over 30.
Yeah, and we're over 30. And I was just, you know, I thought it was so ironic, you know, because I was just 30 at that time.
The enemy.
The enemy, and I became the, overnight I became the enemy. But, what was I going to say? Okay, so here I am in the office, and to be perfectly honest, I didn't have a whole lot to do, you know. We're not going to start from the beginning.
I think, because it's only 33 seconds over.
Oh, okay.
So, it's now 1968. You're the enemy.
I'm the enemy. Okay, but, you know, so a lot of us, a lot of people in the office started sort of redefining, you know, what we were going to do. And there was a big sort of introspective student affairs-wide conference that I think we call Project Awareness or something, and there was a report which recommended all kinds of things for all of, at that time, student affairs included the registrar, the admissions, the union, residence halls. Mm-hmm. It was huge. And we don't need to go, this is not part of what we're here to talk about, but in the aftermath of that, they started to break it up, you know, into smaller units. The legislature didn't like the idea that so much money was attributed to student affairs, you know. So they put counseling in the School of Ed, and they broke off admissions and registrar. I mean, they did all kinds of things. But one of the recommendations that came out of that was to develop a grassroots mechanism for engaging students, which turned out to be the Campus Assistance Center. It started out as a sort of a rumor control telephone line during the worst of the anti-war demonstrations, and evolved by 1970 into a full-scale office. I mean, the first, and I should be talking about this to the other, I mean, but the first thing we did was we borrowed a truck from physical plant at registration, and we went around to some, remember, registration in those days, they had concentrations of kids, you know, going to the different points.
Sure.
Where they registered. And we would show up and set up a table, you know, and put out a bunch of catalogs and people who knew some things and answered people's questions, you know. And it was very successful. I mean, it was very well received. And we began in our own minds, and we kept statistical track of how many people we talked to. We began to recover from the worst of the anti-war movement, in the sense that now we were able to talk to students again. And that evolved into the Campus Assistance Center when that old house on Lake Street became available, they gave it to us. And we started a full-scale operation of answering kids' questions about every aspect of the university and often, you know, the community. And, well, you know, the rest of that.
Sure.
is history.
Yeah.
But during that period, I met Professor Joe Kaufman, who was in was in Education Administration, was the name of the department then, and I had been sort of floundering in terms of the PhD degree, because the UW really wasn't didn't have a specialty into what I was interested in, which was student affairs work. But Joe was, I mean, he had been a dean of students, and Cipperly introduced me to him. I can remember sitting in the Broad House, three of us. And Joe asked me, you know, what I was interested in, and we talked about that, and he said, well, you know, I think you could get build that into a degree program. I said, really? And he said, and I'll be your advisor.
Really? He volunteered to be your advisor?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that was like, I mean, after floundering, I mean, I graduated, I got a my master's degree in 1961, and I had gone part-time in the EDD program at Columbia while I was working. And so I'd been floundering around for close to 15 years, you know, without making the kind of progress I thought I was going to make. And I met Joe Kaufman in 1976, and I finished writing my thesis in 1979, you know, 3 years, which I considered, and was working at the same time. You know.
Were you going to school full time? violating the 150% rule?
Thanks to Bob Miller,
we got around it somehow.
You know, they discovered that I think one of Senator Proxmire's assistants got a PhD in political science and never showed up at the university.
Oh, so no one mentioned.
Yeah, so that 100%. I can't remember, but exactly how we did it. But Paul Ginsberg, who was the dean, was very helpful. I mean, he wanted me to have this. And so whatever we had to do to satisfy the requirements, we did. I couldn't tell you any more chapter and verse just how it worked out. I mean, I think one semester I might have had, you know, maybe 7 credits and so on. But and then he also gave me time off while I was doing the research. And not complete time off, but enough to get it done. And then I wrote a summation of, the PhD, the thesis was 350 pages, you know, and I wrote a 60-page summary, which was then provided to all of the, because it had to do with student affairs, it was, had to do with help-seeking, student health-seeking behaviors. In essence, why, you know, as applied to student affairs, it was what prompts students to seek help from the various services we offered. And so I wrote a 60-page summary of the thesis, which was distributed to all of the directors, and I did a couple of seminars on that. And at the time, you know, I don't know if it changed anybody's mind about what they were doing.
Was it published widely, or just did you have it published?
It wasn't published. Oh, okay. I mean, all the theses are published. They made it into a book.
Right.
And my paper, my summary paper, was distributed. I mean, it was.
Did you give it at conferences too?
I think I might have at one conference. Yeah, I didn't do. To be perfectly honest with you, it's one of the regrets that I take with me into my later years is I didn't do more with it, because in all modesty, it was a pretty good effort. And Joe really liked it. Joe actually nominated. There was a. That I think it was either ACPA or NASPA gave out a Thesis of the Year award to graduate students. And Joe nominated me for that. As it turned out, the nomination went in late and mine was never considered. But it was enough for me. I mean, I so respected that man that, you know, that was enough for me that he thought well enough of it to do that.
Did you continue that line of research while you were here?
I made one other effort. You know, there was this, I like to tell people describe my career, you know, that we went through this whole succession of movements, you know. I mean, there was the anti-war movement, there was the civil rights movement, there was the feminist movement, there was gay, and, you know, gay rights and all of that, and every time, you know, the Dean of Students was right at the office, you know, was right at the forefront. I mean, we would do self-help seminars and tea groups and all of the things that were popular again to make us more aware and more responsive to the, because they all played out in various student, you know, iterations.
Sure.
Okay, so in terms of this, when it was civil rights, and I don't know whether I was asked or volunteered or whatever, but we attempted to replicate the research using minority students. Because it was clear from the original research that minority students weren't help seekers in the same sense that other, you know, cadres of students were.
They had different behaviors that were
right,
them.
Right. So that, so.
Or they used each other or something.
Right, but we couldn't, I mean, we tried, but we never could get the cooperation. It was that time, you know, here was this white guy trying to ask questions of black students, and we had money from system to do it, and we spent some of the money, and we ultimately had to quit because we just couldn't get the participation you needed to generate enough figures, you know, to make the kind of projections you needed to make.
It would be very interesting to be able to compare the help seeking strategies of different groups.
And I, you know, again, regrets. I'm sorry I didn't I didn't do it because I liked it. I personally thought it was important, but you know, it was the Dean of Students Office, and it was Paul Ginsberg, and it was take on all comers, you know, whatever the problem was, we're going to deal with it. And there wasn't a whole lot of time, you know, and there wasn't a whole, I mean, and this will play into, you know, some of the issues that came before the academic staff, and, you know, is that we were clearly administrators, you know. And it was very hard to cross over and be both, you know, be an academic staff person and have the initiatives or exercise the initiatives you might want to do some things that were clearly on the academic side.
Interesting that the administration themselves would say it's hard to cross over, you know, because there was the perception that y'all could do whatever you wanted.
Yeah. The department wanted me to teach a course. After I graduated, Steve Meyer will tell you the same thing because we were in some classes together. The department was teaching courses that they called, you know, student affairs and higher education, but all they did was find people who were practitioners like myself and Steve and others, and
sure.
In essence, we would teach the course, or even though we were students. I think Barbara Wiley still hasn't forgiven me. Yeah, Barbara.
Oh, sure. For teaching?
No, not for teaching, but I remember in one course, Professor Mara Futh,
sure.
he said, Steve, he says, I'll make you a deal. He says, you can either take the exam or write the exam, meaning prepare
it for me.
Well, I wrote the exam. Barbara had to take it.
Oh, how funny.
And you know, with her sort of her droll response to this day.
I hope she did well.
I don't know. Anyway, so I actually got a PhD and I finished in 1979. I waited around till 1980 because I had been at it so long I wanted to be part of the big graduation.
Oh, great.
And there's another anecdote. We'll never get to this. But okay, so it's 1980. I'd now been at the university for 12 years, and of course I knew everybody, including everybody who was marshalling. So I get to graduation, and Blair Matthews, who's a marshal, comes up to me and says, Steve, he says, it's a big honor to be the first one across the platform, so you're going to be it.
Oh, how cool is that?
Okay, so wait a minute. I thought it was cool too, and I agreed. But it was when everybody graduated at one time in the stadium. All the graduate students, all the medical students, all the nursing students, all the undergrads.
Oh.
And so it was 4 hours.
Oh.
So after the first 5 minutes, I was done. And I just sat there. I mean, it was so totally boring and anticlimactic.
And there
were no place. But yeah, you know, I was the first. And I remember Shane looked at me, you know, as he was about to shake my hand. And he had no notion, why would he, that I had even a graduate student. He said,
nice to see you. Great, could we give you one? So now, you came during the Vietnam situation.
Yep.
Did you have to do military service, or were you lucky enough to get out?
No, between my age and my standing in graduate school and the fact that I was a parent or about to be a parent. I mean, that was the last contact I had with the Selective Service was when my oldest daughter was deemed viable.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I got my dad out of Korea.
Yeah, so that was the end of that. I was actually in the Air Force ROTC in college, and I flunked the physical for flight training, or I might have.
Oh.
Might not be today, but it turns out I'm colorblind.
Interesting.
So they won't let you in a cockpit if you're colorblind, which is probably just as well.
Yeah, just as well. And then you were not tainted as the enemy when you're dealing with students.
Right.
You know,
right.
So there's some real advantages to
right.
that one.
Although I still remember, God, I can't remember his name. The director of the health service was in the National Guard. at that time. You know?
And got called up?
Well, it was like, you know, during the day, he was that in his? I don't know, but I remember there was this dichotomy, you know, during the day he was treating these kids, or maybe in the late afternoon he was treating the kids during the day. I mean, it was.
Oh,
but there were lots of. Yeah. I can't remember the details of the one I'm going to. But there are a lot of stories like that.
You got tear gas in your eye? Tough it out.
Tough it out. Yeah.
So, what was campus like when you came? You said an administrator could not get involved in some of the more academic things like teaching and research.
I don't know that it was impossible. I thought it was difficult. And student affairs, you know, which was my career, the thing that I love. Madison, in my memory, was not it was not all that supportive, you know. I mean, you sort of had to. The position of the administration in my mind as well, where, you know, there's certain things we have to do. I mean, we have to admit students, we have to register them. You know, there wasn't complete agreement that we had to counsel them if they had issues, mental health or otherwise. Of course, we had to do academic advising, but student organizations, you know, fraternities, sororities, all of that.
Yeah, I remember the comments about it's a whole lot cheaper to have hammocks and outside the dorm windows, so when they jump, we catch them. You know, that was.
Yeah, I mean, there
on
was.
Campus when I first came.
There was a lot of that. There was a lot of that. So there was a lot of trying to just, in addition to doing the work, you also had to justify the work you were doing to the higher ups.
How much flexibility did you have in doing your work? I mean, was it, you're hired to do this and then?
Well, as it turned out, I mean, within student affairs, there was a lot of flexibility. I mean, because people like Chan Young and Paul Ginsberg were committed, and if you had good ideas, you know, and here I was trying to make this whole novelty work, you know, the idea of campus assistance and sort of instant communication with students, and in a way it was a good justification, because Paul, you know, Paul could spend hours with one kid. I used to think about that a lot. Here we have 40,000 kids on campus, and Paul will spend hours. I'm not criticizing Paul. He's a wonderful guy.
And he got his own phone.
Right. But you know, I figured out a way that we could, I mean, they weren't in-depth conversations, but we could make the institution a presence for thousands and thousands of students by using some of the, you know, what was available to us at that time. You know, I mean, I see what the campus assistant started. I see the continuum today, where now we have instant communication via, you know, email and Facebook and Twitter and cell phones and all with our students. That's the way we communicate with our students.
Except on furlough days.
Except on I haven't followed that. But, you know, so I feel like that's sort of what we started in 1970 when we started the campus assistance center. And Paul, you know, when push came to shove, you know, he had the numbers, you know, there are numbers, you know, but when somebody questioned, well, you know, how are you dealing with students? Well, you know, the campus assistance center talked to 100,000 kids this year.
Yeah, 100,000 contacts would not be unrealistic.
No. We had gone up well over a million before I left.
Wow.
in the early 80s.
So what was the relationship like with faculty? You were the administration, you were academic staff. What was your sense of how that relationship was going?
Well, there were faculty who, you know, who were sympathetic, who understood, you know, who saw the bigger picture of what happens at an institution, who understood what makes up a positive undergraduate experience, and how, you know, some of these other things that we were involved in, union programs, residence halls, whatever, contributed to the success, which has later been justified by actual research. I mean, it's today everybody sort of agrees, you know, that having lived in a residence hall makes you more likely to succeed than if you didn't. You know, but in those days you were constantly arguing. And we had faculty friends and other faculty thought it was a lot of fluff and why did we need it and it was a waste of money. You know, and
it depends on which faculty.
Yeah, which faculty we were dealing with. And I wasn't overwhelmed by our leadership, you know. Ed Young was a nice man, but he was a hardcore academic. I'm not sure he really understood what we were doing. And Shane the same way.
Okay, so the relationship varied depending on. What's your sense about whether that has changed or has that stayed the same?
Interesting that you asked that question because not very long ago, I guess it was last fall, Susan Fisher from Financial Aid, we had asked her, Steve Meyer and I asked if she would show us the new quarters in the Lucky Building, you know. And I mean, here are all these wonderful spaces devoted to the kinds of things. I mean, when you think of, we were running this program out of this whole falling apart building, and Financial Aids was in the old faculty club after having been moved from an old house, you know, and here, wonderful spaces for everybody, spaces for student organizations and so on and so forth. And in my mind, I said, well, you know, maybe the university's finally arrived, you know, in terms of accepting student services as a full-fledged part of the institution. And I tried that out on Susan. I said, well, what do you think? You know, because she's been around long enough to have some of the same memories that Steve and I did. And she agreed. She feels like it's no longer a question of acceptance now. I mean, the baseline is we will have all of these functions as part of the institution. We will support them. We will give them the space they need. I mean, now you can quibble around the edges about, you know, direction or how much luxury you put into the facilities you give them, but it's no longer a question as well. Maybe we don't need to have a dean of students office. Or maybe we don't need to have a counseling center.
Okay, so it was really that very basic back then.
Yeah.
This might not happen. I know the office I was in was completely cut out and told to go away, testing and evaluation. We don't need course evaluations. Faculty can score all their own exams. And it became self-supporting, and that saved it. But otherwise, it was on the chopping block. But what did Susan say anything about, or have you gotten a sense of how these very critical services are, yes, they're provided for, but are the people that are providing them equal status now with faculty and administration? Have academic staff been able to jump that gap and become partners?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I mean, that's, you know, if they have, it's happened since I left. Although, I thought the direction was there, you know.
They were headed in the right direction.
They were headed in the right direction.
And when did you leave? What year?
1999,
okay. But going back now to when you first came on board, there was no academic staff governance. Students had governance rights, but they had governance rights.
Well, you know the story. In the merger legislation in 1973, there was no mention of academic staff as a separate contingent within the university hierarchy. I think there was an assumption in the time before that, going back into the 30s and 40s and 50s, and I'm not sure some other historian in the university probably has the answer to that, but I know that prominent administrators were given faculty titles so that you could, they were faculty without a really departmental home. I mean, the director of the union was a professor of social education or something, and Newell Smith, I think, and Larry Halley, and people like that, and residence halls had professorship titles. Chan, I think, had a faculty.
So it wasn't that they were promoted through the faculty ranks. They were brought in.
Yeah, they were just given.
And given them.
I mean, that's the limit of my knowledge. I just know that I don't know the history of that. You have to get that.
No, I do know that they. Someone said, and what do they profess if they're professors? And then academic staff somehow got legislatively created. I'm not sure how that happened after merger.
Well, 1973. So for about I have these dates because I was. My first two-year term on the academic staff committee started in 1982, and the committee, the committee was partially elected and partially appointed by the chancellor.
And that was the advisory committee
There was an advisory committee to the chancellor, but my impression is that committee had been in existence for probably 3-4 years before I was appointed to it.
I think in 1978.
Yeah. So you went for 5 years with nothing, and then the awareness started to grow amongst different people that there was no legislation, no statutory enabling of the academic staff to participate where there was for students, and there was for, obviously, for faculty. And the faculty hierarchy, you asked me before about faculty. I think they were resistant at first, because the university committee faculty tended to be the most, they were all tenured. They were the most prominent. They were the people that had the biggest stake in the status quo. They had the power. They ran the university. They were the ones that became the chancellors and the provosts and the vice chancellors. And the idea of sharing power with another group didn't sit too well with them. And the other interesting thing is that as academic staff sort of looked around and decided we needed more of a role, it tended to be people who had fairly significant, mid-level and above positions in the university who were already involved in policy making.
And were sitting on committees.
And were sitting on committees, but didn't always have, you'd have this sort of anomaly of having the registrar, let's say, on a committee ruled by faculty, depending upon him for all of the material they needed to make their decisions, but maybe including him in the decision making, maybe not, very uneven. That was something we discovered as we were organizing, that the role of the academic staff on the policy making bodies of the institution was all over the board. It was all custom, Some committees, every committee certainly that dealt with an issue where there was a comparable administrative office, like the registrar and student programs or whatever, had a committee, dominated majority faculty, but the administrator, one or two of the top administrators were always on the committee. Sometimes they made their policy by a vote and included these people. Sometimes they didn't. You never knew. And those were some of the first issues we addressed once we got the governance. The other thing that I remember, this is real clear in my mind, because as a student services administrator, when I thought about academic staff, I looked around and I saw all the other student services people, and we all dominated. We had no faculty in our departments. There were no faculty members in the Dean of Students department. What's going on out here? But then when the institution, when it became known to everybody that there was this body that was building, a representational image for the institution in terms of academic staff, people came out of the woodwork, librarians, lab techs, all these people came with stories, and I would sit and listen with my mouth hanging open, people who couldn't move out of their lab, from 9 to 5 unless the faculty person in charge of the lab said, you go,
And take vacation while you're at it.
Yeah, yeah. And that was one of the one of the first major issues of once we went from the academic staff committee to the academic staff assembly, where now we I can't remember what the number was, but however number, these people said, well, it's great, you have a meeting at 4 o'clock on Thursday. I can't be there because my faculty member won't let me. You know, so that was one of the first issues.
And yeah. That letter still goes out to this day, once a year.
Yeah.
So you're one of very few, maybe only two that I can think of, people that actually bridged from the ASC Advisory Committee to ASEC, the Executive Committee. What's different about those two?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, because this is going to sound terribly immodest, but I was the bridge.
You were the bridge.
There were others, but I became chair of the old committee.
Chair and chair.
And then chair of the academic staff executive, and then elected to the academic staff executive committee after governance. And it was something I didn't want all that much, but people kept saying, we're in this transition, we can't have a new person. So
right.
I actually served for almost 4 years,
yeah.
You know, from one to the other.
And I think it's very important that you did that. It did give us the consistency. The other thing it gave us, quite frankly, was the respect that you had brought to the position. You know, by having you transition over, it wasn't like, oh no, we threw the ship out. You know, all the returns are going to come out of the board. You were a known quantity, you were a reasonable quantity, you were a professional quantity, and I think that made a huge difference.
I just, for the record, I wanted to, because I was elected to a 2-year term in 1982 on the old Academic Staff Committee. I was reelected in 1984, 1986, and in 1988. And then I was the chair from 1985 to 1986. The governance was, I think it was 1985.
And governance,
we were, here's another interesting thing. We, as an academic staff committee, trying to figure out what came next. We knew something was going to come next. And the unions were all over us.
Right.
Teachers union, the local branch of the NEA, I think it was.
AFT,
yeah. They were all over us. Well, you ought to be a union, you ought to be a union. Well, a lot of the people, especially, again, you know, the most prominent people in the academic staff were already administrators. And it was always iffy whether, if we did go union, whether they would accept us.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of reluctance. And we were on the verge of inviting the union reps to address a meeting that we were to call. Interesting thing is, nobody ever came to meetings except when you talked about staff benefits and salaries and titles and those things. Then everybody. So we were about to call a meeting, and give the various unions that approached us a chance to make their spiel. And then we were going to do, I can't remember whether we were going to do a survey or a referendum or something, but we were going to get the sense of the academic staff about what they wanted to do next. And then, and I can't tell you a lot of the detail, but then the legislature passed the budget. Somebody had gotten to a legislator who had stuck this 36.04, you know, into the statutes.
Yeah,
and we had governance,
yeah.
You know? And so we tabled indefinitely the whole union thing. And I remember, I'm sure it was Steve that I said this to. Because we along with others had this reputation of being sort of, you know, rebels. You know, we were, even though we weren't in the union camp, a lot of the faculty and people didn't look real closely to all, you know, the rabble rousing union types, you know. And I said to Steve, I said, it reminds me of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you know, who was accused of socializing so much the country. And he said, well, yeah, but I'm saving the country from communism. And we were accused of all this rap, and I said, yeah, but we're saving the university from union.
Yeah. Yeah, really.
You know. And so anyway.
Yes, Joe Zarnesky, who used to be academic staff, is the one who tacked that on out of Milwaukee. He was academic staff at UW-Milwaukee. And we had asked him not to. We said, no, we want this to be a separate bill,
right.
Because this is pure, right. And it's right and good. And he said, I can get it in, and we said, okay. You know, it was one of those where we, and thank goodness. So now, this is in the legislation, and the academic staff have to organize themselves.
Right. Well, that was, we set ourselves, at, we still remained the committee, because we needed to have a structure in which to hold an election. And so the first task, of course, was to write the Articles of Organization and
do you remember who did that?
And the bylaws. Tom Hoover.
Really?
Tom Hoover did a lot of the grunt work. I think he was just about retiring and he had one of these sort of in-between tweener positions that was created, and he did a lot of the work, and then at some point we hired, I can't remember the exact chronology, we hired Bob Miller, of course, and Bob, and plus the committee, we were all doing it.
Bob is the Secretary of the Academic Staff?
But there was a precursor that probably nobody remembers. Somebody ought to ask Tom about that before he leaves us. But I can't remember how we created this position, but Tom did a lot of the grunt work in terms of writing articles of organization and bylaws and stuff like that. But we all worked on it. I mean, nothing went through that the committee didn't at least eyeball and give their opinions. And
how did the districts happen?
I don't remember.
Because they're an interesting group of titles,
yeah,
as opposed to a geographic.
Had you not just prompted me to think about that, I wouldn't even have thought about that. And I remember that was a discussion, but I just don't remember.
Well, it remains today a very big part of academic staff governance because of the high turnover, and not necessarily people actually leaving the institution, but changing jobs. And so the titling is 400 plus a month in many years, where they have to be either, they're coming on board. I would imagine it's less right now in this economy, but somebody new's coming on board and has to be districted, or somebody has changed and needs to be redistricted and put someplace else, even though their office may have remained the same, so the geographic doesn't happen except as a secondary kind of consideration. And it's a very it is cumbersome, but it's a very finely tuned kind of gradation, with the assumption that they all have something in common. And I never found I had too much in common with my district mates, but anyway.
I have to think about that one.
And offices are split. At one point, an office I was with had 7 different districts represented.
Really?
In 12 people, because of such disparate titles. And yet, I would have thought we were a constituency. But you can't be in a district with your immediate supervisor. And, you know, there was some a real concern about being influence to vote a given way if your supervisor was in the same district.
I have a vague memory of those discussions, but I couldn't. Yeah. I can't add to the history of that.
Okay. So you were quite long involved in the advisory, and then into
longer than most people, because we got caught up in and several people on the committee too. I think Sue was on that too, Susanna. We were longer than you know would ordinarily be indicated, but because we were all caught up in the transition, we opted. People asked us to stay, and we did.
And as you look back on it, would you do it again?
Yeah. I mean, I had a great deal of pride, you know, in being part of this group, and at the same time that we were doing this, we were realizing how far-reaching it really was. Again, you know, as I said before, in the early stages of our awareness, we thought, I thought, you know, that academic staff was just sort of the people I came in contact with, you know, in mostly in student affairs and a few marginal offices like yours and some of the academic dean's advising offices and so on. But then, you know, we're in the school, we realized we were representing librarians and lab people and people all over the campus, and people who did not have a voice, had much less of a voice than we did, you know. We thought we were disadvantaged, you know, but what we learned was we really weren't. I mean, maybe, you know, in a situation where, you know, you're the prominent person in an area of administration and you don't have a vote on the committee, that was not right. But then we learned that there were people who couldn't move out of their workplace without permission from somebody else. I mean, that was the extreme in my mind. And so, you know, what I thought, and those people that we were with, we all thought, whoa, you know, this is really worthwhile. I mean, we're not just representing the interests of people who are, you know, fairly well paid on the total scheme of things and have a, you know, a responsible job. There are, you know, on the 4,000 academic staff, the people we were thinking about were maybe representing a couple of 300. The rest are all over the place. Some of them weren't even in the, you know, some of them were out state in some of the, I don't know what
the farms.
The farms, yeah, yeah. The other labs.
Yeah. Interesting. So, and in fact, that number is up to 65.
And then Esther, remember Esther?
Olson
got involved and introduced us to this whole, what do they call that?
The synchron.
Yeah, that one.
Synchrotron. Whatever.
Yeah.
And that whole.
The whole thing in Stoughton. And, and then we went to, I remember, I got in on a lot of things like the search committee because I was the chair and I was asked, well, maybe that was later, I don't know. But I went on one of these Wisconsin Ideas seminars, you know, travels out of the state. We met academic staff at some potato research facility, you know, 300 miles north.
At UW-Madison academic staff?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was out of the School of Ag.
Okay. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
They don't get to meetings much, though.
Yeah. It was even, I remember some, when we were doing Hayes Hill, we discovered that there was some sea captain that was somehow affiliated with the Sea Grant program, who was academic staff.
A sea captain.
And
he was driving a boat?
Driving a boat
all
somewhere,
right.
Maybe on the Great Lakes, I think.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. He had an appointment with the Sea Grant.
Collecting research.
And he was academic, you know, anybody that didn't know what to do with, they put in there, you know, academic staff. Who had any kind of professional credential. Couldn't put him in the civil service, so the academics down.
Okay. How effective do you think governance has been with the issues that you were concerned about, like committee representation, allowing people to attend meetings, like had been too big?
Yeah, I thought, I mean, that was, again, I mean, our first concern was the organization that we had to build. The second concern was making sure that the people who, because of their responsibility, were automatics on committees also had representation that we felt they deserved. Okay. Then the third thing was probably the rest of the committees, you know, committees that weren't necessarily dealing.
Lectures committee.
Right. That academic staff, especially if they had any relationship at all to the work of that area, by the time I left, and to be perfectly honest with you, I mean, since I've left, with one or two exceptions, I haven't really kept up. But by the time I left, I felt that we were reaching a level of equality, of participation in the committees where we should be. That was pretty well entrenched. We might not have been there, but the direction was definitely established. And part of it had to do with, to be perfectly honest with you, with losing some of the opposition by way of retirement or passing, or, you know.
Indeed.
So, I mean, I think the culture today, what little I know of it, if I had this conversation with a, you know, with a 32-year-old faculty member, they'd look at me like I was crazy. I mean, they don't have a problem.
Okay.
But maybe they do. I don't know.
We still can't be co-chairs of committees.
Okay. See, I don't know that.
Some would say, but wait a second, we really don't have representation on committees at the level that we should. Having one or two academic staff on a committee of 10 doesn't cut it. We are more than double the number of faculty. What would be your response to that? And you hear it most often with the athletic board.
Well, the legislation, and I'm sure it hasn't changed, never gave us equal representation. It required that we have representation, but left the ultimate responsibility to the faculty. Now, if you disagree with that, and if you press me, I would disagree with that, you know, then you have to change the legislation.
I'm not sure I do disagree with it.
Okay, but in terms of the legislation, we are, again, as I was leaving, I thought we were headed for the place that the legislation wanted us mm-hmm. to be.
And I think we're there. I think we're there. It's not equal, but I think it makes sense for the roles that we play, and we do have voting rights. And they brought back emeritus status, so you know some things are in fact.
Is that gone? I mean, I haven't read this. Does that
right,
mean for the...
Away. Remember, it went away for a while, and we could only get distinguished status.
Yeah.
And so people like Bob Heideman retired under distinguished status. And as it turns out, going through his papers, now that he's gone, it turns out that was a parking issue. They did not want to give parking to academic staff in retirement, so they did away with the emeritus. After we got governance rights, that changed. We got it changed relatively quickly back because what a silly reason to take that away. And then all the distinguished became emeriti. But it was a parking issue. Kind of stunning. You know, we were disenfranchised because of parking.
Yeah, that's right.
But it came
parking
back.
Was always, you know,
the
ghost in the closet every time you met about almost anything.
So from your perspective, it sounds like you feel pretty good about the successes academic staff had while you were here, and that when you left, they were headed in the right direction and continue to be so today.
Well, whether they can, you know,
although
unless we regressed in the 10 years since I left, then I can't speak to that. You know, at the time we left, there was the whole Donna Shalala phenomenon, you know, I think can't be overlooked in this. One, she was the first chancellor to be picked, or not picked, but to be recommended by a search committee that included academic staff, you know.
Really?
Yeah. I shouldn't. There may have been academic staff on previous search committees, but at the time of the Shalala search committee, the academic staff had already established itself as a legitimate agency on campus with governance rights. So she was the first one after that, okay? And if you think about it, and again, we'd have to check our history, but she was probably, if not the first in a very long time of the chancellors to be picked who did not have a history on the Madison faculty.
Right.
Okay. So her thinking was not based in this sort of old boys network that we had before that. And she was more respectful. I mean, she recognized, as she assumed her office, she recognized that some of the people who were partially responsible for putting her there were academic staff. And she never forgot. I mean, she was a lot of things. But anyway, we won't go there.
But
she
was supportive.
She never forgot
always.
That. Right. And always. She was supportive, and we started having assembly meetings when when she was in Madison, she was always there. You know, if she needed to say something, she would. So during, you know, during the period of her chancellorship,
did she chair the Academic Staff Assembly? Did she? She was there so much.
Yeah, I can't remember whether she was, because Bernie Cohn was also there. As a matter of fact,
I know now the provost does, but
yeah, it's,
I think to begin with, she might have.
Because this was a resolution that they passed that the initiative came from Bernie, who was the vice chancellor,
right,
acknowledging all of the work that we had done to get to governance. And I think he was the presiding.
Yeah, okay. But she was there a lot. This is amazing. I haven't seen this before. That's wonderful. I always adore it.
You know, I did and I do, but he was a contradiction when it came to the academic staff, because I went to Sue Finman's retirement, and Bernie made sort of a dedication, and in the course of this speech, you know, he lauded her, in effect, for keeping the academic staff at bay. I mean, and for, here is this academic staff person, Sue Finman, whose major accomplishment, according to Bernie Cohn, is for maintaining the rights of the faculty in the face of, and I'm being harsher than he probably said it, but the intent was, you know,
in the face of the threat.
Sue held them off.
Sue was very anti-union.
Yeah.
And several times she took me to lunch to tell me how bad unions would be. And so I would have said she staved off the union piece.
But a lot of those folks confused
the issue a little bit.
Confuse academic staff governments with unions.
Yeah. Because I just have to say, Bernie Cohen was the most supportive person ever when I chaired ASC. And then years later, when I was chairing ASEC, he would call me and tell me all the inside scoop on everything so that we would not be caught off guard. He was, to this day, one of first memories. Yeah. I'm sure it was because I was young and he maybe thought a little naive. But boy, he saved me.
No, he's
me.
A sweet man.
And Toby, you know, has always been supportive of academic staff as well. So,
yeah.
Anything that we have to
turn this off for a second. I'll tell you, because this doesn't belong on here, but I'll tell you a quick anecdote.
Steve, can you tell us now, looking back, what you're most proud of, what you did either in governance or for the university in general, when you look back and say, yeah, that was worth it?
Well, I mean, there are three things that stand out, and certainly governance is one of the three, you know, and in my mind it wasn't just participation, because a lot of people participated, you know, and I think we have to be grateful to all of them. A lot of them will remain unnamed, but being there at the transition and starting without a framework for governance and ending up with articles of organization and bylaws and a functioning body that, you know, remains today. And, you know, I look at a lot of things that I was associated with, and the measure is, well, are they still there? You know, because a lot of things have come and gone as part of this institution over time, but governance is still there. And it meets my requirement. It's still there, and it's functioning, and I was there at the beginning. And that's important to me. I mean, outside of the realm of governance, of course, the Campus Assistance Center, this whole, it wasn't just that agency, but it was the whole idea of it, you know, how to communicate with students, how to have a conversation with a lot of students in an institution of this size, you know, it's something that's been replicated at a lot of institutions now. And, you know, there isn't some documentation which gives credit to the University of Wisconsin for originating the model. The commission for, there's a United States Commission for Excellence in Higher Education, it's called, it's actually called the Committee for the Advancement of Standards, publishes standards for a lot of the programs other than the academic program that exists in higher education. And there's a section on visitor and information services that it, and the in the introduction, it acknowledges the University of Wisconsin for having started this whole thing. So, I mean, it's hard not to be proud of that. And of course, that again meets my requirement. It exists today as the Information and Visitor Center and the Campus Information and Visitor.